Since we've been teaching for so long, it's a decon.
So we hardly need to pay for a hotel anywhere. It's great. And especially, you know, seeing them in action in their own parishes when they're thriving, it's a great joy. Great joy. So let me get my... Yeah.
Okay. All right.
This is our eighth church that we're visiting on this tour, last one. And every one of them has one of our alumni as the priest. So it's been a little homecoming every time. Yeah. So it's been really neat.
All over the country.
This is all the great American Northwest. Yeah. Came to Billings, Montana first, and then Bozeman, Kalispell, Montana, Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, Tacoma, Washington, Portland, Eugene, and here. And we've blended in along the way, visiting five national parks. So we've had a lot of great scenery, too, as well as great fellowship. So I'll be the main one. I know Father's trying to include Mary. This particular presentation I've been doing for a while now, but certainly she will join in with the discussion time. Okay. Father has mentioned already something that I wanted to emphasize in the beginning. How so often when we think of the saints, we think of the monastics, maybe the hermits in the desert. And even when we think about the church fathers, what were they mostly writing about? They were mostly monks. And we might have the general impression that they never really did talk much about marriage. This is all one reason that we put together this book, Marriage as a Path to Holiness, Lives of Married Saints. This is actually the second edition. The first edition came out in 94. That was our first book we did together. It has about a 35-page introduction, an Orthodox understanding of marriage, and actually we sent it to the monastics in Essex, Father Sophroni's monastery. We feel very connected with them, especially Father Zacharias. So we were grateful to get there kind of imprimatur on it. This is the second edition. Came out a couple years ago. It has 50 more lives. So altogether, it's got about 180 lives of saints who are married. So it's a great affirmation in itself that we have married saints, that marriage is indeed a way, a path to holiness. And the church fathers, when they talk about marriage, they always say the goal is the same. It's just two different approaches to really the very same calling to become saints, right? To be filled with the Spirit, to be joined with Christ, to be people of prayer. And sometimes, I'm going to share a quote from Clement. Sometimes they say it's an even greater kind of achievement if married people can stay close to Christ and bring every single aspect of their life under the Lordship of Christ in the midst of the solicitude to their spouses and children, you know, and the rigors of life in the world, that can sometimes even be seen as a greater achievement. Chrysostom, for instance, says the monks, of course he might be exaggerating a little bit. He has kind of that tendency sometimes. But at one point anyway, he talks about the monks in their cells, nothing bothering them. They don't need to read the Holy Scriptures as much as the laity in the world, because they're in the midst of such a kind of frenzied existence, making their way in the midst of all the temptations of the world. So I hope tonight will encourage us in our married lives, affirming that our church does talk a lot about marriage. Of course, we have the incomparably wonderful marriage service, and that's certainly a great affirmation of the holiness of marriage in itself, even that it's called a sacrament. Says a lot along that line. But also to enrich our understanding of, to deepen our understanding of marriage, and by through talking about the vision that our church has, a glorious vision for marriage. You know, it says in the scriptures, without a vision, the people perish. So, I think we all need something grand to be striving for, to encourage us, you know, to inspire us. Certainly not to discourage us, you know, because maybe we're not at the top of the ladder yet. But God knows where we are, right? We're all at different places in our personal spiritual lives and in our marriages, in all of our relationships. And the whole point is simply to be looking forward and taking each little step in that direction. St. Paul says somewhere, even despising the things that lie behind me, I press forward to the goal, right, of the prize of the high calling in Christ Jesus. So I hope we all can be enriched and deepened in our understanding of what really Orthodox marriage is all about. And my avenue, my approach to this is going to be through the saints, through the church fathers, as they have spoken about marriage through the centuries. So I'm going to be turning to this book that came out last year, Glory and Honor, Orthodox Christian Resources on Marriage. Have any of you seen this yet? Anybody? Okay, well, we recommend it. Mary and I helped to edit this book. It's got about 30 essays on various aspects of marriage by 26 contributors. Let me just read some of these names you have probably heard of. Father John Oliver wrote the book Journey to Heaven, right? Frederica Matthews Green, we've all heard of her. Philip Mamalakis at Holy Cross Seminary has a wonderful book on parenting now, Parenting Towards the Kingdom. We highly, highly recommend that. Dr. Albert Rossi at St. Vladimir's. H. Tristram Engelhardt, Dr. Engelhardt. He's really a world authority on Christian bioethics. Father Alexander Webster, you might have heard of him. Father Hopko, one of the last things he wrote before his repose is in here. Father Zacharias, I've already mentioned him at Essex. He has a brief reflection on marriage and monasticism. And Father Matthew Baker, who died tragically about 2 years ago. We have two sermons of his that relate to marriage. So, And then the last article in the book is called Noteworthy Quotations Relating to Marriage from Within the Orthodox Tradition Through the Centuries. So we'll be starting with the Apostolic Fathers. I always like to emphasize them because a lot of people, it seems, never really wonder what happened after the Book of Acts. And they kind of have the impression that the lights went out after the last apostle died and never came back on until, you know, Martin Luther or John Calvin. Or if for the Pentecostals, the lights still were pretty much out all the way until the Azusa Street Revival, you know, 1905. So we of all people, the Orthodox, should have a deep sense of history, right? So tonight we'll even have a little kind of quick journey from the first to the 21st century, okay? As we share quotations from many saints through these centuries. So we start with Saint Ignatius of Antioch. And he says in his epistle to Polycarp, "It is fitting for men and women who marry to be united with the bishop's consent so that the marriage may be related to the Lord. Everything is to be done in God's honor." So, the bishop's blessing makes this makes sure every marriage is offered to the Lord. So, which reminds us immediately that marriage itself is something holy. It's divine. It's God's institution, right? When he finds Adam lonely, right, and needing someone like him to be his helper. And so he fashions Eve to be his helpmate, his wife. And so it's our responsibility then to receive marriage on his terms, you know. Male and female, he created them. Then St. Polycarp of Smyrna, mid-second century, in his epistle to the Philippians, the same church that St. Paul wrote to about 50, 60 years before, he says, "Teach your wives to walk in the faith given to them, and in love and purity, tenderly loving their own husbands in all truth, and loving all others equally in all chastity." So we have here the kind of the both and, you know, the special relationship of husband and wife, but their love then meant to shine forth to everyone else. You know, it's not just some exclusive thing where the husband and the wife are somehow gazing at each other all day long. I remember Father Hopko once said, that's not an image of Orthodox Christian marriage, gazing at each other. It's side by side, arm in arm maybe, hand in hand, but reaching out to the rest of the world then in that way. See? Okay, then Clement of Alexandria, late second century. Some very wonderful words here. Marriage as a sacred image. A sacred image. Must be kept pure from those things which defile it. We are to rise from our slumbers with the Lord and retire to sleep with thanksgiving and prayer, confessing the Lord in our whole life, right? Every single moment of our life. Possessing piety in the soul and extending self-control to the body. Okay? The prize, now this is the quote I was referring to earlier. "The prize in the contest of men is won by him who has trained himself by the discharge of the duties of husband and father, and by the supervision of a household, regardless of pleasure and pain. It is won by him, I say, who in the midst of his solicitude for his family shows himself to be inseparable from the love of God. So, for Clement and for all the fathers, they proclaim that this is possible. You know, sometimes I think, sometimes I'm afraid the priest hears people saying, if you really, you're talking so much about holiness, sanctity of life, that's for the monks. You know, not really for the married. But it's not true. Absolutely not true according to the fathers or any of the saints. Another quote along the same line. Well, okay, I'll skip that one. We have to watch our time. I know this is to get through all the 20 centuries. Okay, St. Athanasius, fourth century. If virginity is distinguished as a priority by some, marriage comes next to it for others who find their glory in it. Have you ever really thought about sheerly, simply, the glory of marriage? Thinking about this helped lead us to this title, Glory and Honor. Of course, this is also a phrase from
the wedding service.
Father, where does this come in?
Crown them with glory and honor.
Crown them with glory and honor. Right. And then receive their crowns, right? Into thy kingdom, unto ages of ages. So we'll be getting to that theme soon, the eternality of marriage. So there's much glory, right? Eternal glory in marriage. At another time, again with St. Athanasius here, at another time the call is made to virginity or to self-denial or to conjugal harmony, saying to the virgins the things of virgins, to those who love the way of abstinence, the things of abstinence, and to those who are married, the things relating to an honorable marriage, thus assigning to each its own virtues and an honorable recompense. And then he says, sometimes the call is made to fasting, and sometimes to a feast. So if we can go by the structure of this paragraph, it seems that the fasting, he's relating to monasticism, right? And the feasting, he's relating to marriage. And that can remind us of course, what is the greatest single image from human experience of God's love for his people? What is the single image most prevalent in all the scriptures?
Bride and bridegroom.
Yeah, it's marriage. Right. And the beginning of the life in the heavenly kingdom is depicted as what? See, this is part of this. The wedding feast of the Lamb. See? So, marriage and joyfulness are connected deeply in our understanding of marriage. Okay, now we come to St. Cyril of Jerusalem, also mid-4th century. These come from his catechetical lectures, teaching those who are catechumens. You have been taught, beloved, the lore of the soul, as far as time allows at present. Now receive as best you can the doctrine concerning the body also. Let no one tell you that this body of ours is a stranger to God. For those who believe that the body is something alien readily abuse it in fornication. So this emphasis, mid-4th century, on the goodness of the body, and by extension all of creation, even after the fall, the fathers in those centuries found it necessary to emphasize this because of a certain heresy, various that occurred in many forms, basically a dualistic kind of Platonic Gnosticism, right? Whereby spiritual things are exalted and earthly things are somehow denigrated to one extent or another. And the moment that happens, our understanding of marriage is going to be denigrated, because marriage is so connected with fleshly things, marital relations, and marriage, then our understanding of it will suffer. If there's any streak of Platonism, it just automatically happens. And even women, our understanding of women as fully equal in the image of God, even that gets compromised so often in these Gnostic systems. This is very important for us to be so clear on. Orthodoxy is soul, so holistic. Spirit, soul, and body, right? St. Paul says, I wish you would be sanctified in your spirit, in your soul, and in your body. See, the goodness of creation, the earthiness of our faith. We use earthly things in our sacraments, right? The bread, the wine, the oil, the water. See? It's all an affirmation of the innate goodness of the created realm. Father Schmemann used to talk about the natural sacramentality of the world. See? Really, we should be walking in wonder at the goodness, the glory, the beauty of every facet of creation, all the time. This is, I think, what we're called to. A sense of wonder, right? And affirming that it's all good, because fashioned by the good God who loves mankind, right? So then he says, what do these critics, what do they have to complain of about the wonderful human body? What does it lack in beauty? What is there in its structure that is not crafted skillfully? Ought they not to have considered the brilliant formation of the eyes, for instance? And then he goes on and on. St. John Chrysostom has tremendous passages about the beauty, the grandeur of creation. Because as long as, of course, we always acknowledge who created it, right? St. Basil the Great says all of the glory of creation is to point us to the Creator. Sure. Okay. Let those be of good cheer who, being married, use marriage rightfully, who order their marriage according to law, not making it wanton by uncontrolled license, who recognize times of abstinence, that they may give themselves to prayer. So that's hearkening to St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. So that's a little bit from St. Cyril of Jerusalem. Then we have St. Basil the Great, late 4th century. The sum of what I say is this. If anyone wants to contract a lawful marriage, the whole world is open to him. But if he is only impelled by lust, let him be the more restricted, that he may know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor, and not in the lust of concupiscence. Now that doesn't mean in any way that there is automatic concupiscence or sinfulness linked with marital relations. That is an error of the West, really, goes back to Augustine. And it has plagued the West ever since. According to Augustine, as much as we admire much of what he wrote, but he had problems in this area. And for him, even a Christian couple, even if they're only thinking about children, still their marital relations are inescapably tainted by lust or sin or concupiscence. So With a view like that, how can we really have a full-scale, positive understanding of marriage? It's impossible. And what's the stand? What's the pastoral kind of expression of this hesitation about the goodness of marriage? It's institutionalized in the Roman Church. Through what? What am I thinking of, do you think?
Celibate priesthood?
What?
Yeah. The celibate priesthood?
Oh, priesthood.
The priest can't be married. Yeah? I think it's that's a real tip-off, I think, to this problem that has plagued Western Christianity and helps explain why there's so much confusion about sexual things in our society today. Let's move then to St. Gregory the Theologian. After Chrysostom, he's one of the ones who writes the most about marriage, and also very, very positive. He says, "Are you not yet wedded to flesh? You are pure even after that. I will take the risk of that," he says. "I will join you in wedlock. I will dress the bride. We do not dishonor marriage because we give a higher honor to virginity. I will imitate Christ, the pure groomsman and bridegroom, as he both wrought a miracle at a wedding and honors wedlock with his presence." Of course, what's the what was the wedding that he attended?
Cana.
Yeah. And according to John's gospel, that's where he did what?
First miracle.
His first miracle. So what a tremendous affirmation of the goodness and holiness of marriage than that right there. See? Jesus himself quotes Adam, right, when he says, "And the two will become one flesh." So we have his strong affirmation of the goodness of marriage. St. Gregory goes on, in our living together, we are each other's hands, ears, and feet. Wow. We are each other's hands, ears, and feet. And this may be more and more relevant the older we get, right? One's hearing starts to go, the other one, hopefully, you know, can do, excuse me, can do the hearing for the two. Excuse me. I'm still trying to get over a cold. He says, "Marriage redoubles our strength, rejoices our friends, causes grief to our enemies. A common concern makes trials bearable. Common joys are all the happier. And accord makes riches more pleasant." It's even more delightful than riches for those who do not have wealth. Another beautiful paragraph. "Marriage is the key of moderation and the harmony of the desires, the seal of a deep friendship, the unique drink from a fountain enclosed, inaccessible to those outside. United in the flesh, one in spirit, they urge each other on by the goad of their mutual love. For marriage does not take us away from God, but brings us all the closer to Him. For it is God Himself who draws us to it." And then he talks about his sister Gorgonia, who is a saint in our church. St. Gorgonia, sister of St. Gregory, the theologian. In his funeral oration for his sister, he says, "My sister Gorgonia also made the fruit of her body, I mean her children, and her children's children, to be the fruit of her spirit, as she consecrated to God not only her soul, but also her entire family and household. She made marriage praiseworthy by how well-pleasing she made her own marriage, and by its excellent fruitfulness. As long as she lived, she stood as an example to her offspring of all that is good. And when she was summoned from this life, she left her example behind as a silent exhortation to her household. Now, before we leave St. Gregory, I'd like to share a bit more about his family. You know, his parents are also saints. Anyone know his mother's name?
Julia.
No, for Gregory. Okay. You're thinking of St. Basil. It's easy to get them mixed up.
Yeah.
The parents of St. Basil were Amelia and Basil. The grandmother was Macrina.
Yeah.
But for St. Gregory.
Nona.
St. Nona, August 5th. She has her own day. And the father, usually known as St. Gregory the Elder, to distinguish him from his illustrious son. And they had a brother. So three children. His name was Caesarius. He's also a saint in our church. He was a court physician, a layman in the world who never got married. So we see basically all three possibilities for life. Married in the world, single in the world, or a monastic, represented by those three children. So here's an entire family who the church is saying the spiritual life is possible to such a degree that all five are canonized saints. So what does he say about his parents? Again, I know we have to watch our time. In their early years together, she could not bear to be unequally yoked with him. Now, what could he possibly be talking about there? We had to put a footnote. Gregory and Nona's husband, when they got married, they were not both in the Orthodox faith. Gregory was a member of a sect, heretical group. And so she, this is such an amazing statement. While she was the strongest and most courageous of women, this alone she was not able to bear, being only half united to God. Wow. Because she was not fully united with her husband in the true faith. Wow. So what did she do to rectify the situation? So she fell before God night and day, beseeching him for the salvation of her head with much fasting and many tears. And she diligently devoted herself to her husband, influencing him in many ways through reproaches, admonitions, attentions, and estrangements. Like everything she could think of, right? But most of all, she won him by her own character, and especially her fervor for godliness, such as is able to bend and soften the soul so that it yields willingly to the pressure of virtue. The drop of water constantly striking the rock below surely will hollow it out and eventually achieves its desire. And this is what happened, as we know. So he does leave his sect and enters fully into Orthodoxy, and then goes on to be a bishop. Now listen to this, how their son really gives all the credit to the mother in helping the father be prepared to be a bishop. Listen to this. This good shepherd was the result of his wife's prayers and guidance. And it was from her that he learned the ideal of a good shepherd's way of life. Well, what a tremendous testimony to the critical importance of having a good wife. right? And listen to this then. Once they were united fully, spiritually, Gregory says, with his wife, his father Gregory was of one honor and of one mind and of one soul. So isn't that, in a nutshell, I think, the vision, the goal that we can be striving towards? To be, literally, of one honor and of one mind and of one soul. This is the unity of husband and wife that we're called to live as married people. Yeah? And if you're not married yet and you want to be married, I don't know, of course, your status, but this is mighty important to bear in mind. Is it someone you can be of one honor and of one mind and of one soul? And all things considered, this is why it's so important, if we're Orthodox, to marry someone who's also Orthodox. Certainly that's the ideal. Of course, it doesn't always happen. Even in this case, it actually didn't happen. But she realized how tremendously important it was to have that unity. Maybe she didn't really quite realize that totally when she actually got married. Or it was an arranged marriage and she may not have had much choice about it even. But we heard how all those things she did to make it happen with God's help. Okay. So let's come back then to our quotations. Now, St. Ambrose of Milan, late 4th century, he did strongly promote the clerical celibacy. But there were other things that he said that point towards a more positive understanding of marriage. He says, "The domestic edifice of man and woman seems to be rich in a certain kind of perfection." So that's high, right? Positive. And then as he interprets the Song of Songs, that Old Testament book, that is at one level a love song, even quite erotic at times. And the church has consistently interpreted this then as what? Imagery pointing towards, like we mentioned before, that marital imagery throughout the scriptures, pointing to God's love for his people, right? Christ the bridegroom's love for his church. And so he interprets, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth." He says, "The soul asks for not one kiss, but for many kisses, so that she may fulfill her desire. For as a lover," he's not shying away, you see, from relating this to the level of human love. "For as a lover, she is not satisfied with the meager offering of a single kiss, but demands many, claims many as her right, and thus has grown accustomed to recommend herself the more to her beloved." He says, "Just as those who kiss are not satisfied to touch lightly with their lips, but appear to be pouring their spirit into each other." See, this is how the soul, how we all, as, you know, the soul is female. I'm sure Father's talked about this. Psyche, the word for soul, is a feminine word. And in response to God's initiatory love towards us, right? Each one of us in our soul is called to respond to him. Okay. St. John Chrysostom. We could share so much from him about marriage. It was such a blessing for me to do my dissertation on Chrysostom, his views concerning women. And as I was reading him, it was such a special joy to see how much he said about marriage. which I didn't realize at first. I wonder how many of us realize how much he extolled marriage and presented such a glorious view of it. Here we just get some taste. He says, from the beginning, God has revealed himself as the fashioner by his providence of the union of man and woman. And he has spoken of the two as one. He says, there is never such intimacy between a man and a man as there is between husband and wife, if they are united as they ought to be. This love, eros, is deeply planted within our nature. It attracts the bodies of men and women to each other. No trace here of anything negative. Some people think that there is something inevitably kind of less than pure about marriage because marital relations may not have occurred in Eden. They only occurred after the fall. But regardless of what happened in Eden, our Orthodox understanding is that God reveals almost like his extra benevolence to mankind at the fall, providing for Adam and Eve in these new circumstances. So the West, there's a real difference, East and West, on this too. The West tends to emphasize the curses, the punishments, you know, of Adam and Eve at the fall. For the Eastern fathers, no. They emphasize God's goodness in working things, in using all of this, working it for the good. So, this is what we find in Chrysostom. God also linked them together by their natural needs, linked them as if by an unbroken bond when he encircled them with the chain of desire. God, so ingenious and wise, used these things for our benefit. Now listen to him as he imagines what a bridegroom might be saying to his bride on their wedding night. He says, he imagines the young man saying, "I fell in love with the excellence of your soul, which I value above all gold. For a young woman who is discreet and ingenuous," or innocent, that can mean, "and whose heart is set on piety, is worth the whole world. For these reasons, then, I courted you, and I love you, and I prefer you to my own soul. And I pray and beseech and do all I can so that we may be counted worthy to so live in this present life that we may be able also there in the world to come, to come to be united to each other with great security." See, even in the next life. Next sentence. Next two sentences. For our time here is brief and fleeting, but if we shall be counted worthy by having pleased God to exchange this life for that one, then shall we be both with Christ and with each other with more abundant pleasure. So I'm wondering, how much do we think about how marriage, our marriages, are meant to last forever? Have you thought about that much? I hope. Widowers know this, right? They know that, especially if they've had a good marriage. Okay. But granted that, they know when their spouse dies, they live on in the next life, and there can be real continuing fellowship, maybe even closer somehow at a more profound level. And when we start to think of it more, we realize every one of our relationships that we fashioned in this life will continue, right? This is intricately part of our understanding of the immortality of the soul, right? That our memories would continue, that our our self-awareness, our self-consciousness, right, would remain intact. I really don't think it's the case. God willing, if we reach the pearly gates, is St. Peter there with a big eraser, scrubbing everyone's minds clean? To start the heavenly life with a blank slate? How could that possibly be? And we only have to look at the Theotokos to realize she is still the Lord's mother, right? She didn't get her mind wiped clean when she entered the next life. We pray to her with, and we remind her that she has what? In our hymns. That she has a mother's boldness, right? With her son, you know? And this also indicates to us, you know, not only our consciousness, but integrally related to that, our gender. We remain male or female through eternity. Of course, everything is transformed if we don't know the exact details of how it all gets worked out. But isn't this one of the great joys that we have at funerals? This great hope that we will see that person in the next life, God willing, and be reunited. Right? So, I hope this all makes sense, and I hope it deepens our understanding of what marriage is all about. Everything we do for our marriages in this life is building for something eternal. Yeah? Okay. Oh, how about this for some very practical advice to husbands? Never call her simply by her name, but with terms of endearment, with honor, with much love. Honor her, and she will not need honor from others. She will not want the glory that comes from others if she enjoys that which comes from you. Prefer her before everything else, on every account, both for her beauty and for her discernment, and praise her. Encourage her to fear God, and all good things will flow from this as from a fountain, and your house will be filled with a myriad of blessings. In another place, he says, two souls so united have nothing to fear. With harmony, peace, and mutual love, husband and wife own all possessions. They can live in peace behind the impregnable wall that protects them, which is love according to God. By love's grace, they are harder than diamond, stronger than iron. They sail in abundance. They steer a course toward eternal glory. There's this emphasis again. Marriage is meant to last forever. Steering a course toward eternal glory. And they attract more and more grace from God. He also has many wonderful things about child raising. Let me just give you a taste here. To each of you fathers and mothers, I say, just as we see artists fashioning their paintings and statues with great precision, so we must care for these wondrous statues of ours. Living statues, of course, right? Our children. He says, painters, when they have set the canvas on the easel, paint on it day by day to accomplish their purpose. Sculptors, too, working in marble, proceed in a similar way. They remove what is superfluous and add what is lacking. Even so, you must proceed. Like the creators of statues, give all possible attention to fashioning these wondrous statues for God. Now, let me just add a little bit here. We just saw an article talking about the tendency maybe in our own time to idolize our children. You know, to almost be enslaved to them, making sure they're as happy as they can always possibly be. I think there's something to that when you see parents saying things like, it's time to go, Jimmy, okay? You know, like you're making sure they give the last word.
I think that gives an impression that you want to avoid.
I think so. Children need limits. We all need limits, right? And our society is pretty much saying, have no limits. Indulge whatever. You know? I'm afraid parents tend to get influenced by that general feeling and treat our children too much, with too much leniency, let's say. Okay. One other idea that's very practical from Chrysostom about family life concerns almsgiving. It's one of his famous, most favorite themes, almsgiving. He says, lay up gifts for the poor at home and make your home a little church. This is a phrase that he uses several times. He may have invented it himself, used it for the first time. Making the home a little church. And what's one way to do that? Make your little alms box a treasury. Become a guardian of sacred wealth, a self-ordained steward for the poor. So what I think he's getting at is actually having a box or a jar in the home that the parents put contributions in, even if it's loose change or whatever, and the children see that and they get encouraged to do the same thing, you know, and then maybe make a, kind of a big deal of presenting that jar or box when it's full, presenting it to a certain charity, maybe even having a kind of ceremony about it. So anyway, he says, your benevolent disposition assigns you this priesthood. Say, with the father as the head of the house, and in a sense, the priest, right, of his household. Okay, oh my. How much time do we have?
Time goes faster on the West Coast.
Oh, gosh. Well, what do you think, really? We're still in the 4th century.
Well, might need to speed it up a little bit.
Okay. Wait, I don't want to overtax your attentiveness. Thank you so much for being here and being so attentive. How about if 10 or 15 more minutes with these quotes, and then we can have some discussion? Okay, I'll try to just be selective here quickly. Another good voice from the West, St. Paulinus of Nola. He writes a letter to Pamachius, a senator, Christian senator, whose young wife had died. He says, you are lamenting a wife worthy of your chaste couch, not because you have doubts about the resurrection, but because of your longings of love. And maybe I should explain right there that use of the word chaste. In marriage, marital chastity in the Orthodox Church does not mean abstinence. I mean, that's part of the married life, times of abstinence and so on, especially for prayer. But it essentially means, foremost, fidelity, right? Absolute fidelity to your spouse. But also, I think it relates to having marital relations with tenderness and gentleness and decorum and dignity and so on. So this would be our understanding of marital chastity. In the West, it tends to mean abstinence, right? But that's taking the word in a different way. Okay. I love this passage, this one line from Ecclesiasticus that Paulinus quotes. For the grace of a wife wins glory from her husband. Isn't that beautiful? The grace of a wife wins glory from her husband when she is in his embrace, and wins his longing when she is taken from him. As she always was, so shall she be a crown for her husband forever. And that sounds mighty positive about the eternality of marriage. Again, what does the priest say in the wedding service when he takes the crowns off? Receive their crowns into thy kingdom unto ages of ages. Exactly. Okay. In your wife now, you now have a great pledge in Christ. She's praying better than she ever did when she was in this life. She's so much closer to Christ. He's saying she is praying for you. Who will make... She's making efforts to win support for you with God. And, okay, the letter goes on. St. Maximus the Confessor, just one line from him, great church father of the 7th century. He talks about the divine erotic force. God loves us with power, right? With great desire. And so this is reflected. We're made in His image. We have these desires. It's the desires are good in themselves, but they need to be oriented in godly ways, right? Or they can become destructive. Sure, we always understand that. So listen to what he says here, just one sentence. We should regard then the erotic force, whether divine, angelic, noetic, psychic, or physical, as a unifying and commingling power. See? Totally positive again. St. Simeon the New Theologian, early 11th century. He says, so it is possible, like we were saying before, so it is possible for all people, not only for monks, but for lay people as well, to be penitent at all times, and to weep for our sins, and entreat God, and by such practices to acquire all the other virtues as well. See, just as possible for those in the world as for the monastics. And then he says that this is true. John Chrysostom, the great pillar and doctor of the church, bears witness with me. So he's reading Chrysostom 600 years after St. John lived. We're just reading him another 1,000 years later, but it's the same saint talking. His voice is ringing down through the ages. You know, same voice. St. Gregory Palamas, 14th century. Practice the single life as dear to God, or the married life as God's gift. Either one. Fully authentic, right? Drink water from your own wells. Okay, talking more about marriage then. Drink water from your own wells, or rather, chastely from your one well. Again, remember our understanding of marital chastity. We must make haste to attain purity and chastity, and avoid fornication and every uncleanness, in order to rejoice throughout all ages with the pure bridegroom in the unsullied bride chambers. Here, next we have St. Angelus the Goldsmith, one of my favorites, martyred under the Ottoman Islamic Turks in the year 1680 in Constantinople. He may have just been kind of an average craftsman, a goldsmith, with 5 children. But under the Turks, the Christians really had a very difficult time. They could be hauled, definitely treated as second-class citizens, you know, if that. And they could be hauled, they could find themselves in front of a Turkish judge almost at any moment. And that's what happened to Angelus. We won't go into the details of his story, but I want to share what he says to his wife. Okay. As he rejects the judge's offer to deny Christ and spare your life, he says, I will never reject my beloved Christ. How do the Greeks say it? Christoulimou. You know, my beloved dear Christ. And what does he say to his wife then? Oh, wife, let Christ be above everything for us. It is to him that I give you and the children today, and for whom I undergo this martyric death with joy. Therefore, my wife, also endure my absence, so that in his fearsome and glorious coming, Christ's second coming he's referring to, right? We will behold each other and rejoice together forever. See, again, we see this. What gain will we accrue from the delightful pleasures of this world if we suffer the loss of our souls, to which the whole world is not equal? Therefore, go in peace, my beloved and dearest soulmate, and I will proceed onward as quickly as possible to my beloved Christ, who will soon come for you, so that we may both delight in eternal blessedness. See? Then we have some practical advice from St. Tikhon of Zadansk, the patron saint of our monastery and seminary, from the 18th century. Let me share a bit from St. Macarius of Optina. You have the Optina elders, right? And I was also so pleased to see the royal family, the icon you have of the royal family. Another example of every member of the family canonized as saints. Such a beautiful image for us to bear in our hearts. Now, St. Macarius of Optina, very practical in his letters, right? Letters of spiritual direction, mid-19th century. He tells a certain husband, the most important thing in your letter is one that you never stress, one on which you ask no instructions, one which you never formulate clearly, but which comes out in every line, the growing hostility between you and your wife. He's not even sharing it to this elder who he's approaching for spiritual guidance. How's the elder going to know, right, how to advise him if he's not sharing this deep struggle? And this should remind us, none of us should ever be ashamed to talk about our struggles, right? Especially with our spiritual father. We all have struggles. It's just part of this life, as we know. So we should be open, feel that we can openly share them. And that's what brings healing. That's part of what brings healing, right? To share our struggles and not just letting them fester inside. Okay. I see little hope of this poison being cast out of your home unless you promptly cease condemning each other. You clearly think you are always in the right. She, of course, thinks she is. You heap on her a multitude of grave or petty accusations. She does the same to you. Where will this end? He says. Your chief accusations against her are touchiness, conceit, an absurdly exaggerated opinion of herself. But surely, if these were not your own most prominent defects, which they surely are, you would not be so greatly irritated by perceiving them in her. How true is this, right? He says, beware of your own failings. See? Then he says, all this financial trouble between you comes from your having completely forgotten that yours is a Christian home, or should be. A home is a Christian home when all the members of the household bear each other's burdens, and when each one only condemns himself. You've forgotten this, both of you. And so every word of hers pierces you like an arrow dipped in poison, and your words likewise pierce her. Ponder the truth of Christian marriage. Husband and wife are one flesh. Does it not follow that they must share all their possessions? And yet you two haggle over this property. And why? Because of words. He says, unless you promptly strive for and achieve a loving peace between you, it's hopeless to try to bring order into your business dealings with each other. Humble yourself, not her. Love her, not yourself. And he also says, no connection on earth is greater than that between husband and wife. It is therefore right that you should stand by your husband. Here he's talking to a wife. No matter what happens. And no one can forbid you sharing everything with him. And then he also reminds us the joint prayer of husband and wife is a great force. I hope we all, as married people have those times, hopefully every day, right? Morning, evening, at least something short, praying together. Beginning the day, ending the day, together. He says, this may be one of the reasons why the enemy is trying to get both of you to break this excellent habit. It is one more temptation which God permits so that you should learn to overcome it and to come out of the testing stronger than before. And then he says, remember that under all circumstances, humility is your surest weapon. We have a little from St. Theop on the Recluse, Bishop Irenaeus of Ekaterinburg. He wrote, his writings are in that book on the upbringing of children. Maybe you've seen that. Then we come to Father Alexander Elkaninov, one of our favorites. Have you seen the book, The Diary of a Russian Priest? He has some wonderful things in there about marriage. He's writing from France in the 20s and 30s, last century. Marriage is a revelation and a mystery. We see in it the complete transformation of a human being, the expansion of his personality, fresh vision, a new perception of life, and through it, a rebirth into the world in a new plenitude or fullness. He says, our modern individualism creates special difficulties in married life. He was writing almost 100 years ago. How much worse is it now? Modern individualism, right? Self-centeredness. Yeah? He says, this creates special difficulties in married life. To overcome them, a conscious effort on both sides is necessary in order to build up the marriage and make it a walking in the presence of God. Then listen to this. Marriage, fleshly love, is a very great sacrament and mystery. Through it is accomplished the most real and at the same time the most mysterious of all possible forms of human relationship. Qualitatively, marriage enables us to pass beyond all the normal rules of human relationship and to enter a region of the miraculous. Wow. And I like how he says, each one should appear every morning as a new, extraordinary being. So tomorrow morning, try that out. Good morning, you new extraordinary being. See what happens. Okay, oh my goodness, watching the time. Let me just make sure you're aware of maybe the greatest Orthodox exposition on marriage, a sermon that we have. It's by Elder Emilianos, Mount Athos. It's in a little book called The Church at Prayer, but it's also very easily accessible online. All you have to do in your search, put marriage, / the great sacrament. And it'll come up first thing. At least I hope it's still doing that. Elder Emilianos, Marriage, the Great Sacrament. He says one thing, he says in there, God made human beings male and female so that different things could be linked together, united, and so that something perfect should be the result. And what he also says in that sermon is, if two people are really endeavoring to live a Christian marriage, they're conscious of the goal, of the calling, they're calling on God for his help, he says their marriage can be a theophany. He uses that word, a theophany. And isn't it true? Going back to Ephesians 5, St. Paul talks about how is a husband to love his wife? Just as in the Greek. Just as Christ loves his church. So, what a calling for the husbands. Of course, that's impossible in our own strength. But with God, all things are possible, right? So that's the calling. That's the calling. Okay?
I know it's time. Yeah.
Thank you for your attentiveness. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Do we have a little time for discussion? Yes, Father Deacon.
Not yet.
Future. Almost. I thought he was on it. Yeah. Future. That was prophetic.
To be later. How are we to understand Christ's response to the Sadducees saying, you know, there was a woman and she married these seven guys?
I know.
Who should be in heaven?
That comes up every time. And maybe I should have mentioned it myself already.
You said a few things that
I
didn't quite expect about the union eternally.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you look at those words technically or literally, what does Jesus say? In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. So that's talking about, yes, no new marriages. People won't be going out on dates, right, in heaven and getting married. No. And parents won't be arranging marriages, right? They neither marry nor are given in marriage.
Okay. Oh, that's just.
But it's not talking about all the marriages that have previously been formed. And especially when we think of the wedding service, who does the uniting? How does the priest pray it? Unite them, right? It's in prayer, it's asking God Himself to unite this man and this woman. The forging, the uniting is done by God.
Not a social contract.
It's not a social contract. We don't have those vows, right? That's so typical of the Western service. I promise this, I promise that. The strength of the marriage doesn't ultimately depend on human vows. It depends on God's strength, you see. And that reminds you of something else in the Western, so typical in the Western marriage service. Those grim words. What?
Till death do us part.
Those are grim words, I think. Till death. Are we really saying death is stronger than love? The union that God Himself has forged? Jesus said what? What God has joined together, let not man join asunder. Well, if we think death is stronger than that love, that married love, isn't that saying the devil's stronger than what God has done? So, does that help?
It does. And their question, the Sadducees' question, had to do with resurrection, right?
Yeah. Well, they were trying to trick him up, for one thing. And the main idea they had was children, right? I mean, the whole thing was a Levirate marriage. Why did the woman have those six additional husbands? It was all to raise up children for the first one who didn't have a child. So, and that's another part of our understanding of marriage in heaven. It's hard to imagine there would still be marital relations, of course, as we know, because there won't be childbearing in heaven. I mean, that's our understanding, right? But in these other ways, that love that has been fashioned, formed, in this life, it must continue forever, just like in all of our relationships. With the additional glory of every one of these relationships being healed, deeply healed to the core, transformed, being everything it was meant to ever be. So, anything else? Mary, do you have anything to add? Any other responses at all? Yes, sir, please.
So, I mean, you do say they are neither married nor given in marriage. So, who's, like, how does the puzzle get answered then of, like, the seven brothers? Would she in the kingdom be married to seven people?
Christ didn't answer that.
He really didn't answer
it. Like, is there a way to answer it?
I don't. I mean, God will solve all those details. They had relationships. I mean, whatever in each of those seven relationships is considered durable, you know, meant valuable to preserve, all those relationships will be healed. So, yeah, and we, of course we don't know all the details. Like I mentioned earlier, the exclusivity, even in this life, is balanced in marriage by reaching out to everyone else, you know. So, surely there will be that kind of, I think, dimension also in the next life. Anything else?
Well, there's a chance. He can answer questions I can't answer. He will answer questions I won't answer.
Yes. Possible for spouses that are separated through repose, through death, to continue a prayer life together.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Another great resource along that line is by St. John Chrysostom, A Letter to a Young Widow. Oh, have you ever seen it? It's powerful. And, I mean, it's actually what St. Paulinus was saying to Pamachius, in a way, even stronger. He was specifically saying, your wife is in heaven praying for you more than she ever could have prayed before. You know, because she's closer to Christ now. Yeah, so that relationship, absolutely. We have a widow in our parish at St. Deacon's, pretty young. Her husband died maybe when he was around 60. She's in her 50s. She goes to his grave every possible chance to commune with him. It's just, I think it's how it's meant to be. Yeah, very touching, very powerful. Even the rock and roll singers talk about, you know, I will love you forever, whatever, right? They know. It's in the human heart. It's in the human heart. I think. Yes?
What guidance do you give to teenagers or parents of teenagers thinking about marriage in the future?
Never too young to start talking about praying. First thing, are you praying? First of all, parents should be praying for the future spouses, right, of their kids. Never too early for that, even from the womb, you know. And then, of course, live in the Christian life as much as possible, husband and wife. This is what the children are going to absorb the most. More than anything we ever tell them. Most likely, right? What does St. Paisius say? Much better to talk to Panagia about our kids than to talk to them about the Panagia, right? So living the life, so it's just so normal. It's just as normal as eating and breathing. Yeah. But, and whenever you can, of course, as they get, as they grow, whatever stage they're at, you can start talking about what kind of person do you want to someday be joined with. If it's girls, hopefully the father is trying to be an example of the man that he would want his daughter to marry, and vice versa with mothers and their sons. So we really are called to be role models more than we probably realize. Yeah. Mary, could you add to that?
Yeah. Well, it can also be useful to talk about the romantic myths perpetuated in the movies and
yes.
Things like that.
Romantic myths perpetuated in the media.
You know, things like if you're fighting a lot, that means you're going to make a great couple.
Oh, God.
It's always going to be starry and perfect.
Right.
Wonderful. You're always going to
feel this great attraction toward each other.
Right. Never having a problem.
Notice that most movies end with them getting married.
Yeah.
Doesn't say anything about what happens.
What happens afterwards, yeah. Another thing along that line, I think, a common trap for girls, I think especially, but can also happen with boys, to marry someone you want to help. You know?
Yeah.
Ooh. Especially girls, I think they want to, they feel sorry for someone, and they think by marrying them they can
change
them. Right? And fix them. Yeah.
Beauty.
So that's, that's a huge one I think we were going to caution our children about. Don't ever marry someone you feel sorry for.
They never think you can make someone stop doing drugs.
Pardon me?
The illusion of marrying someone you can help. I don't think you can get them to stop drinking or doing drugs.
Yeah, it's a similar kind of thing. Yeah.
Someone told me the other day the only time you change someone is when they're indicted.
Okay. 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 Yeah. And if we ever do really want our spouse to change about something, we have to look at our own hearts first, right? And find that place of inner peace where we're not desperate for our spouse to change one way or another. And it may be there's something inside us that needs changing. And once that gets addressed, then everything gets worked out. Yes.
In our very confused society, sexually, right
so
now.
So confused.
Very confused.
I know.
With all the gender confusion and homosexuality and everything else.
Yeah.
How do we, with all these issues around us, how do we help our children be able to deal with this?
Yeah.
To not make judgments in the world and keep a healthy outlook on sexuality like you did, like you expressed your own father in marriage?
Yeah, the gift of our maleness or femaleness is so precious in our understanding. Yeah, Mary?
There actually are quite a few articles in that book.
Yes, in this book.
That you could read yourself and then kind of share.
We'll get that book to the bookstore, so we'll have it soon.
Or, give some of them might be appropriate for them to read. You have to depend on the situation. But there are a lot of, they covered many topics, many possibilities.
Yeah, there's one especially by Father John Oliver that talks about how we are accused of homophobia and how that word is just so lightly, tossed out there, right? But the word literally means fear of sameness, you know. And he says, how can anyone know what's in my heart, you know, when I'm defending the distinctness, right, of males and females. So
Father John Hopko had that book.
Okay.
Same sex attraction.
Father Thomas Hopko.
Yeah, Thomas.
Yes, that's a great book.
Very good book.
Same sex attraction came out about 10 years ago. Yeah. So yes, sir.
This is for us academic, but I'm just curious what your general thoughts might be on the age of marriage. I've had a tendency to think that if people are healthy, I don't mean physically, but as human beings, that young marriage is probably to be encouraged.
I think so. St. John Chrysostom sure did. Yeah. He looked at it, he was so practical. He looked at it in terms of the power of sexual desire. And if, of course, back then there was the standard practice of arranged marriages. Yeah. So in that general cultural setting, it was easy for him to say, fathers, mothers, make sure you get your children married, because they had the responsibility for arranging the marriage. Make sure they get married early, 18, 20, so that they don't have to wrestle longer and longer with the strength of sexual
desire. But the same, in one sense, be true today, as long as it's not with a different culture,
I think
different ethos.
Of course.
As long as it's natural.
Sure.
So they don't have to, like Paul would say,
Right. I think so. It's just as practical today. Yeah.
So that you think that is real consistent with Orthodox?
I do.
The father.
I do. Yeah. Young people marry. I mean, yeah. It's another example of how the Christian thing is virtually the opposite of whatever the mainstream society is saying, right? Or what's happening. Marriage, people delaying getting married longer and longer and longer. Yeah.
Just a couple of things there. Obviously, that's a generalization. It depends on the person.
Of course.
But that being said, I read a study just a few months ago about, since the tendency is now for people to delay marriage because they want to pursue career and so on and so forth, that people do get married later. They also struggle more and more in marriage because they're now set in their own ways. So it's harder to actually now share my life with someone else,
yes,
because I'm used to my ways now. No, I'm the boss. I do, you know.
Very good point.
You know, so even in our culture, it gets harder to adjust.
But they've also had other relationships.
And other relationships.
You know,
yes.
Other partners.
Yes. More and more likely these days. I know. I know. And Chrysostom even is very clear on that. Very clear and practical on that. He says the young men, they shouldn't have memories of other encounters, right? He says, if your son has been having these previous encounters, he's going to be less likely to be fully faithful to his wife when he does get married. He knows. He knows about these things. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
What you talked about, being evenly yoked.
Yeah.
An Orthodox marrying another Orthodox.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, many of us are converts, and now, you know, we particularly have three boys,
okay,
and two converted with us. One is intending to convert,
okay,
soon.
Okay.
The eldest of our boys.
Okay.
In college, and you know, he's right there. He's in college. There's no other Orthodox.
Well, that's a problem.
In his college, necessarily. He is going to an Orthodox church at the moment. But
well, that's good.
Yes,
I mean, that's amazing.
But then there's the back and forth.
Yes.
He's here for the summer. He's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there,
yeah,
you know, it's just.
Yeah.
Well, I guess praying. Us
praying is the main
for
thing.
Him,
sure,
to find,
sure,
an Orthodox way. We're
that's right.
Bring that Orthodox way too. But
yeah, may
it
be.
Is. There's.
May it be. Yeah.
Just who were the parishes to?
Well, yeah, like
the
Christina.
Yeah,
and Robert. So,
just a very practical thing, you know, for young people. I encourage every young person to get together with other young Orthodox.
Absolutely.
In any pan-Orthodox setting.
Absolutely.
That they can. You know, summer camps, visiting other parishes, going to, you know, youth events, and all of these different things, because they happen along the West Coast, and it's worth it.
Yeah.
Not just so that you can go and find a pretty girl.
Right.
But just to me, it's just that fellowship, that's
so
the Benedict Option, the book that is out right now, mm-hmm, talks about networks of resistance against, mm-hmm, this culture of death, right? It's important for young people to get together, you know, and to have that. So I encourage that.
Very important.
You know,
yeah, absolutely.
It's a good thing.
That's right.
You know, but
that's right.
It can't be fleshly either. Where is she? Where is she?
Well,
her, you know,
that's all part of it.
Calm down.
That's all part. That can, yeah.
That's the attraction of St. John's.
Sure, of course, right?
Here, yeah.
Sure. To every single girl.
No. Right. No, prayer above all. God is the great matchmaker. He's in the marriage business. It's his thing, you know. So he wants our children to be happily married. He wants us all to be happily married ever after. I mean, that's his desire for us, even more than we may desire that for ourselves. Yeah.
I just want to thank you for spending so much time on the eternity of marriage. It's really hard, and I think my husband proposed about 3 years ago, and through that, I mean, the different priests have told me we're not meant to be separated, and that's why it's so painful. But it's good to remember that. But again, it's
hard. Of course, it's very hard. Very hard.
Yeah, I just feel like I was ditched, you know?
Oh, God. And just think of his prayers now for you even stronger than they ever were.
I know he prays for me. Yeah. He knows that I need it. So thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank God.
Oh, my. Yes.
All right, thank
great
you.
To be
thank
here.
You, Dr. David. Thank you, Dr.
You.
Mary, for being here.
Yeah.
So this was, of course, just an introduction to a huge thing. You know, he was just scraping the tip of the tip of the tip of the tip of that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
On all of that, even just with the quotes. So these books we will have in the bookstore. I also know Dr. David said that he has some handouts that I will send out to the whole parish that you can look at, you know, later, and you can print out at home if you want. That you would have as well. So this is of course just kind of a reminder and an introduction and a teaser, you know. But everything is in the walk of life. So may the prayers of the saints, the words of the saints, continually guide us and encourage us in that. So, and thank you for bringing that to our attention. Right. Glory to God.
Glory forever.